From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, director John Woo talks about making action films in Hollywood and Hong Kong. His hit from earlier this year, Face Off, is out on video. Also, Bob Doro talks about his jazz songs and the songs he wrote for the animated TV series Schoolhouse Rock. He has a new jazz CD. Rhythm and blues singer Charles Brown turned 75 this year. We'll play an excerpt of his Fresh Air concert, which included his now famous song, Merry Christmas, Baby. And film critic John Powers reviews Titanic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. More than a million chickens, ducks, and other edible birds are being destroyed in Hong Kong as part of an effort to block the spread of the mysterious bird flu. Another person in Hong Kong has contracted the disease, bringing to 13 the number of known cases so far. Four of those people have died. The British government is launching a full inquiry into conditions in Northern Ireland's top security prison known as the Maze, following the murder of a leading Protestant paramilitary leader there over the weekend. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The announcement of the inquiry was made following a three-hour meeting between Britain's Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Mollam, her Security Minister Adam Ingram, and prison officials at the Maze. Saturday, Protestant extremist Billy Wright, a.k.a. King Rat, was gunned down in the Maze by imprisoned members of the Catholic extremist group, the Irish National Liberation Army. Paramilitaries from both sides are held in the Maze. The investigation will focus on how guns were smuggled into the prison and how the INLA men gained access to the roof from which they shot Wright. The three INLA members who admitted killing Wright appeared in court this morning. One of them, Christopher McWilliams, said Wright had been executed because he was plotting the murder of Catholics from his cell. Michael Goldfarb, NPR News, London.
President Clinton is set to order federal and state agencies to try harder to recruit children who qualify for Medicaid but haven't yet signed up, often because their parents don't know they're eligible. An estimated 3 million children are poor enough to qualify. Mr. Clinton's plan calls for government agencies that already come in contact with parents and children, such as Head Start, to seek out children eligible for the program. Federal disaster officials will be in central Florida today after a weekend tornado swept through rural Polk County. Homeowners are hoping for disaster relief aid. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports from Orlando.
The tornado left a path of destruction starting in Winter Haven, which is the home of the Cypress Gardens tourist attraction. The twister ended at Haines City, which is where the Kansas City Royals baseball team goes for spring training. No one was killed, but 8 people were injured and 2 were hospitalized. Polk County officials are still adding up the damages, but preliminary figures put the loss at nearly $5 million. 80 houses and mobile homes were destroyed, and close to 150 other homes were damaged. There's also concern for more flooding throughout central Florida today. Steady rain started around Christmas Day, and there's a good chance for more showers and thunderstorms today. Many forecasters blame the El Nino effect for the unusual weather that's been hitting Florida. El Nino is credited with keeping the 1997 hurricane season quiet, but things could remain cold and wet in Florida this winter. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up over 93 points in moderate trading of 200 million shares. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is up just over 16 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks are sharply higher to begin the final trading week of the year. The technology sector has helped pace some of the early advances as investors return from the Christmas break in a buying mood. Japanese semiconductor firms are moving to cut capital spending in the coming year, as Daryl Gibson reports from Tokyo.
Nihon Keizai Shimbun, Japan's largest economic daily, said Toshiba, Fujitsu, and NEC all expect cutbacks next year, ranging up to 30% less spending than in 1997. Although the paper did not mention specific reasons for the downsizing, industry analysts suggest expected fallout from the Asian currency crisis will cut demand in Southeast Asia, while overseas markets in Europe and North America may not see massive growth. Toshiba, in one cost-cutting move, is expected to contract out some of its semiconductor manufacturing to a Taiwanese company, while NEC expects to slash some $115 million off its spending for next year. Total 1998 capital investment for NEC is seen falling to about $1.3 billion. and that Fujitsu is expected to reduce its expenditures for new plant and equipment by at least 30%. For NPR News, I'm Daryl Gibson in Tokyo.
Sales of previously owned homes remained at strong levels last month. The National Association of Realtors says home resales fell 0.2% from the record level set in October. The trade group says low interest rates and a healthy economy help keep sales strong. Bethlehem Steel will discontinue its money-losing coke fuel division in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, by the end of March. The company says it can't return the operations to satisfactory profit levels. About 800 jobs will be eliminated. Hundreds of unemployed workers blocked trains in French towns today. They were demanding extra financial aid from the government. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year's hit action film, Face Off, is now one of the most popular videos in the country. On this archive edition, we have an interview with the film's director, John Woo. Face Off was Woo's third American film after having made 26 movies in Hong Kong, including comedies, martial arts films, and gangster films. Some of Woo's Hong Kong films, especially The Killer and Hard Boiled, developed a cult following in the U.S. Woo made his first American film, Hard Target, in 1992 with Jean-Claude Van Damme. Woo followed that up with Broken Arrow, which, like Face Off, starred John Travolta. In Face Off, Travolta plays FBI agent Sean Archer, who is pursuing psycho-terrorist Castor Troy, played by Nicolas Cage. In a complicated plot twist, Agent Archer goes undercover, taking the identity of the terrorist Troy, after government plastic surgeons transplant Troy's face onto Archer's. But then, terrorist Troy forces the doctors to give him Archer's face. So the good guy now wears the face of the bad guy, and vice versa. Travolta and Cage have a ball with this identity swap. Here's a scene shortly after the transplants. The terrorist, now wearing the face of the FBI agent, comes home. He walks into the bedroom of the FBI agent's teenage daughter, and instead of being the strict father, he's leering at her lecherously and looking approvingly at her cigarettes.
You're not respecting my boundaries.
I'm coming in, Janie.
Janie?
I don't think you heard me, Jamie. You've got something that I crave. Papa's got a brand new bag.
Clarissa left those here.
I won't tell Mom if you don't.
When did you start smoking?
You'll be seeing a lot of changes around here. Papa's got a brand new bag.
Ow!
I'll do the jerk. I'm gonna do the swing. You're doing the twist, just
like this. I asked director John Woo how he cast John Travolta and Nicolas Cage.
When I got a script, the first person in my mind was John Travolta. Because I truly believe why John playing a good guy, he's so much convincing and it looks so real. And then after the switch, when he became a bad guy, and he will definitely will bring a lot of fun. And he looks so charming while he's playing a bad guy. And then me and John suggest using Nicolas Cage. And for myself, I always dreamed of working with Nick Cage because I found he's not only a great actor, he also is a man with a great heart. You know, he's a really care about the other one and care about everything and also very serious about everything. So I we put them together, and that make us feel these two gentlemen, they're really the perfect match.
It's so much fun to watch them take on each other's characteristics after they've traded faces and traded personalities. Did you make any suggestions to Cage and Travolta about what they should copy from each other?
Yeah. Most of the funny thing was created by John and Nick. So like the way Nicolas Cage walk and the way he talk and it just looks so funny. And John was imitated from him, you know, how he walk, you know, and how he talk. So they work very hard on rehearsing. And the other thing is that I also did some experiment. And then during the shooting, I saw all the cutscenes to both actors, let them to watch each other scene, and then to let them to learn and imitate from the tape. So they will never make any confused, and they go with the characters as well.
That was interesting, an interesting idea to show them outtakes that weren't going to be used in the film.
Yeah, because, you know, there are not much people who would like to do that, because some of the director will rather, you know, keep it secret, you know.
There's a scene toward the end of Face Off in which all the characters each have their gun out and each person has their gun pointed at somebody else. So everybody's got a gun pointed and everybody's got a gun pointed at them. You had a very similar scene toward the end of The Killer, in which the two men who have been pursuing each other through the film have their guns drawn on each other in a stalemate. And Quentin Tarantino borrowed that at the end of Reservoir Dogs. How did this become an almost signature shot for you?
Well, I just want to show, you know, all men are equal, you know, no matter the good guy or the bad guy, and they all only have one chance to live or die, you know. While making The Killer, I tried to create a moment is to show they all mankind, they all pretty much the same, you know, no matter the good or bad. And also the idea was came from the Mad magazine, Spy vs. Spy.
Really?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the Mad magazine and the cartoon. You know, the Spy vs. Spy, the black and white bird against each other. But even though they are enemy, but actually they are friends. So I tried to create a equal moment to show that. So that's why that. Became my trademark. Because in my theory, I always believe there's no really a good guy or bad guy in this world. I think all the mankind, they all have a very special quality.
So you read Mad magazine when you were in Hong Kong?
Oh yeah, I read the Mad magazine for years. I'm a big fan. Yeah.
Now, a lot of people describe your action scenes as looking beautifully choreographed, and you've said that you've been very influenced by Hollywood musicals in how you do the action scenes. What Hollywood musicals do you particularly love that have influenced your action scenes?
Well, mostly the old classic musical, like Singing in the Rain, it's lots of Fred Astaire's musical, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, West Side Story, all the jazz, you know, and The Wizard of Oz. I have seen a lot of musical, and besides the musical, I also a big fan of the cartoon, you know. So that's why my kind of action sometimes pretty much like a cartoon.
In talking about how dance films, how musicals have influenced your action sequences, yeah. I would imagine that was even more true in some of the Hong Kong films in which the fighting was martial arts fighting and you were doing a lot of, you know, hand-to-hand and foot-to-hand
yeah.
kind of combat. That's very choreographed.
Yeah. Yeah, I... some of the kung fu film, they are very, very choreographed and also pretty much like dancing as well. Because most of the Hong Kong director or stunt coordinator, they have been trained by the Peking Opera. So they are very good at those kind of like dancing action, you know.
Were you trained by the Peking Opera?
No, never, never.
Do you dance? Do you dance at all?
Yeah, I dance a little. When I was in high school, I was a ballroom dance instructor. You know, I taught folk dance, waltz, tango. You know, so I feel myself as a dancer. You know?
That's
so
great.
that's why when I say that, you know, choreography, the action, it seems like I'm dancing, you know. I'm dancing with the actors.
Now, what were some of the things that you did with the camera and with the speed to make the fight scenes more dramatic? Things like slowing up or speeding up or slowing down the scene.
Well, each shot, I would like to set five or six or three or four camera, and each camera have a different kind of speed. You know, like one is a normal speed, the other maybe 120 frame, the other maybe 60 frame, you know. And then I put them together, see how it look, how it feel. And then I edit with a soundtrack. I mean, it means I cut with the music. I usually use a soundtrack to cut with the scene. So when the mood or when the music rhythm go, that will usually give me the feeling to use the normal speed or to using slow motion or slow motion shot. So and then after we put the whole scene together to go with the music, see how we feel.
Is there either an action scene or a fight scene that you can break down for us almost shot by shot and tell us how you made it?
Well, it's a little hard, you know. Of course, at the first beginning, we did some storyboard, you know, but I just use it for the reference. And in Hong Kong, you know, I have never used any storyboard. So, because I like to create everything on the set. When I go to the set, I would like to see what I had. And I usually choreography everything by myself, sometimes with my assigned coordinator. And I put myself as a character, as a hero. So if I usually see how I feel first. Okay, for example, if I'm in a lobby and ambushed by 20 guys, okay, and I only got two guns in my hand, so how could I deal with all those 20 guys? So I need to figure out myself first, and then I will choreography with my stunt coordinator and demonstrate with my stuntman. And then I will rolling on the ground and get up and shooting some guy on the left side, and then spin around, jumping in the air, and taking care of some of the guy on the right side. If I like to keep the beauty of the body movement, keep it look great, if I'm spinning in the air, then I will like to put some other two guy up on the ceiling. And then I shoot them in the air, you know. If I feel I could do that, it will make me feel my actors also can do that.
When you were making martial arts movies, did the actors ever accidentally hit each other really hard and hurt each other?
Oh, yeah. In the old time, yeah. You know, and some of the actor wasn't a real kung fu guy, you know, so they hurt each other by accident, you know. It always happened, you know. Except that once a while for the Hong Kong martial arts film, they went crazy, you know. They Jackie Chan or Sammo Hung, those kind of movie, they like to, you know, hit the guy real. They're really kicking the guy and beat up the guy. You know, in the mid 70, you know, the people used to like to do that. Some actors will really get hurt.
My guest is film director John Woo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Woo, director of the film Face Off. Now, you moved to Hong Kong from China with your parents when you were 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah.
What was the neighborhood like in Hong Kong where you moved to?
It was really bad, you know. As I raised in a slum, you know, we live in a very bad neighborhood. You know, like drug dealers, the gambler, the prostitutes. And a gangster, you know, and every day I got to deal with a gang. I even beat up by the gang quite often, you know. So I have to struggle very hard and fight very hard. You know, I got to fight back to survive.
Were you good at fighting back?
Yeah, you got a feeling like to live or die, you know. So I was so lucky to have a great parents. That's my mom and dad. They taught me to go for straight, and I also helped by the church. Since our family was so poor, they couldn't afford me to go to school. And an American family, they sent the money through the church to support my school fees for 6 years. That's how I got education.
No, I understand that your house burned down.
Oh, yeah.
When you were young. Where did you live after that?
We were living on the street for 1.5 years, like all those homeless people, you know. So, but we are we've never had any self pity, you know. And my father usually give me a lot of encouragement. So I'm so proud of my parents, yeah.
When you were growing up in Hong Kong, what were the movie theaters like?
In the old time, most of the Hong Kong people, they were so much crazy about a theater. You know, they love movie because since we're all poor, you know, the only entertainment is to watch a movie. And in old time, the parents can bring the child into the theater for free, you know. So I usually sneak into the theater to watch every movie.
You lived in Hong Kong until what 4 or 5 years ago. You made most of your movies in Hong Kong. Most of your movies so far. Is one of your reasons for moving to America the takeover of Hong Kong by the Chinese?
No, not really. You know, about 5 years ago, I was invited to come to this country. Since my movie The Killer draw a lot of great attention, you know, from the studio, Universal Studio, there were so much interest to working with me. So I took the chance because I just felt. Since I already work in Hong Kong over 25 years, I think I've done enough. You know, I really need to learn something more, something new. So that's why I came here. And the other reason is was about my family. You know, in Hong Kong, I work crazy. You know, I work 7 days a week, 18 hours a day, and I. Spend most of the time in the office and in a studio. So my children, they were barely can recognize my face, and they're getting to hate me, you know, because they have never got the real love from their father. So and that really scared me, because the family is the most important thing to me. So that's why I decided to move to the stage. But when we moved here, I find the people here, they never work on a weekend, you know, and so everything back to the normal.
What have been the most difficult things to adjust to about working in Hollywood?
About a system, you know, because in the first beginning, I have never know they were so complicated, everything so complicated in Hollywood. And also, there are so many people involved. And I have never get used to, there's so many producers and so many meetings, just lots of meeting. And it could take 6 or 7 months just for a meeting and repeating the same thing. And I have never know the star got so much power. You know, the star can control the script and also could control the co-star, you know, everything. I just... a little confused to me, because I always felt for making movie should be simple. Everything got to be simple. And also to make a movie should be a lot of fun. The other thing was there was a different feeling about the heroes. You know, that, when I got here, I've been told that in the American movie, for the American hero, you know, they never die, they never cry, and the hero got to be very strict. And then I said, well, it kind of boring, you know. As my kind of hero usually in between the good and the bad, you know. But the great thing I have found in Hollywood is all the studios, they're really, really open. And they really gave me a lot of great respect. The other thing is that I also found that the people here, they are so much professional and dedicated.
John Woo, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Director John Woo recorded earlier this year. His movie Face Off is now on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, music for A Blue Christmas. We hear from Bob Durow, who recorded Blue Christmas with Miles Davis. Durow, who wrote many songs for Schoolhouse Rock, has a new jazz CD. Charles Brown performs his rhythm and blues hit Merry Christmas Baby, and John Powers reviews Titanic. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Dorough's best-known songs have lyrics about math and grammar. He was the music director and chief songwriter of the TV cartoon series Schoolhouse Rock. Many of the kids who grew up on those songs are adults now and don't know about the other side of Dorough, his jazz songs. A new CD, Right on My Way Home, is intended to introduce them to his jazz music. Dorough started recording in the 50s, in the days he idolized Charlie Parker, but while the boppers were blowing chord changes, Dorough was writing and singing songs. Miles Davis liked his singing, and they recorded Blue Christmas together. Most of Dorough's records have been on his own label. His new CD is on Blue Note. Here's a song from it, written by Frank Lesser.
I get the neck of the chicken, I get the rumpled seat ride, I get the leaky umbrella, everyone shoves me aside. When I wake up each day with the dawn, sure as fate, I'm too late, and all the hot water's gone. I get the neck of the chicken, I get the hand-me-down tie, I get the cock in the kitchen, I get the small piece of pie. That's why I can't get over this dream come true. Now, if I get the neck of the chicken, how did I ever get you?
Bob Dorough from his new CD, Right on My Way Home. Last year, Dorough told me how he got involved with Schoolhouse Rock in the 70s.
Well, let's see. I had met the advertising people who concocted the idea. And my partner, Ben Tucker, in fact, wanted us to write a little advertising music. He's a bass player, Ben Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
So one day, this gentleman from McCaffrey and McCall Ad Agency said, "We're looking for a guy to put the multiplication tables to music." And Ben Tucker said, "My partner, Bob Dorough, can do anything. He can put music to anything. Well, let's have him up." So I went up to meet the president of the agency, and it was his idea, and his name was David B. McCall of McCaffrey and McCall. He said, "My little boy can, you know, sing along with Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones, but he can't memorize his multiplication tables." So I had the idea, why not put the multiplication tables to rock music and call it Multiplication Rock? What do you think? And I said, "Well, yeah, that's pretty interesting." And he said, "Well, but don't write down to the kids." Well, I learned later that he had invited other Broadway songwriters to do this task, and they came up with a more simple doggerel type of songwriting, writing down, as it were, to children.
So when he said, "So what do you think?" What did you really think?
I thought, well, yeah, this this could be, you know, a limited idea. But when he added, "Don't write down to children," the hackles on my neck arose, and I got quite intrigued. And so I agreed to tackle it, and I spent about 3 weeks before I would let myself write the first song. I thought first, looked in math books, and since I picked my first title, it was called Three is a Magic Number, I even looked in magic and occult books for the reasons that three might be a magic number.
Did you get anything from those books that
I
you
did,
used
indeed.
In the song? What'd you get?
Mm-hmm. Well, that it was one of the magic numbers, and that it was, embodied in certain things like the Trinity, the old sayings, the heart and the brain and the body, faith, hope, and charity, trinities of sorts. So I got mainly that, trinities. And, of course, I also was an admirer of Buckminster Fuller, so I was thinking of his triangle concept that makes construction so strong.
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to your version, the original version of Three is a Magic Number. Now, did you sing on this one?
Yes.
Okay, why don't we hear it?
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number.
Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number. It takes three legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand. It takes three wheels to make a vehicle called a tricycle. Every triangle has three corners. Every triangle has three sides. No more, no less. You don't have to guess. When it's three, you can see it's a magic number.
Now, do you think most of the people who grew up listening to your songs, and most of the people in the bands now performing your songs on the new CD, do you think that they have any idea that these weren't written and performed by people in advertising agencies or theme houses, that they were written by you, an interesting and eccentric jazz performer, and that the other songs, some of the other songs on here, are sung by interesting and eccentric jazz performers?
Yes, well, I'm sure they didn't even think about such things. They grew up and they learned and they watched. They were a captive audience, one of my partners pointed out, George Newell, because, you know, they were watching Saturday morning cartoons, and suddenly there would be this little three-minute film, and they got hooked on them, and it actually did them some good. And as we went on in our productions, I kept bringing in some of my buddies from the jazz world. So it was a kind of a, a little bit of a underground movement there.
Yeah, well, you brought in Dave Frischberg, the singer and songwriter and pianist, trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon, singer Blossom Deary.
Yes, Grady Tate,
mm-hmm.
A drummer who sings, or a singer who drums. Excuse me, Grady, I didn't mean that.
Now, I'd like to give our listeners who've been hearing your Schoolhouse Rock songs a taste of the other side of Bob Dureau. So I thought I'd actually play something that you recorded in concert on our show once that you've also recorded on your own records, and it's a song called I'm Hip, which you co-wrote with Dave Frischberg. You did the music, he did the lyric. And,
that's right.
And he also worked on some of the Schoolhouse Rocks. He did I'm Just a Bill. And so you recorded this on Fresh Air in 1982. This is Bob Dureau, piano and vocals, I'm Hip.
Well, I'm a hip, I'm alive. I enjoy any joint where there's jive. I'm on top of every trend. Look at me go, vo-de-o-do. Bobby Dylan, he knows my friend. We're so hip, hanging out in Malibu. Well, I'm hip, but not weird. Like you notice, I don't wear a beard. Beards wear in, but now they're out. They had their day, now they're passé. Just ask me if you in doubt, 'cause I'm a hip. Now I'm deep, deep into Zen. Meditation and macrobiology. And just as soon as I can, I intend to get into narcotics. I gotta try some of that stuff. 'Cause I'm cool, cool as a cuke. I'm a cart, I'm a cat, I'm a kook. I get so much out of life. Really, I do Scooby-Doo-Boo. One more time, play Mac the Knife. Let her rip. I may flip, but I'm hip.
This was just a fantastic recording, and I'm really proud that you did it on our show. So,
well, thanks.
In a self-serving way, I'll just get that.
I've gotten many reports from NPR fans saying, oh, we heard you doing I'm Hip on Fresh Air.
Oh, good.
That's
good.
Great. It's lasting.
Good.
Well, that's me. That's the other me. That's what I do. I go into smoky nightclubs and play the piano and sing.
What's the difference in the kind of tune that you'd write for one of your own jazz songs and for one of the Schoolhouse Rock songs?
Well, it's more in the beat than the melody. I might do anything for a Schoolhouse Rock song, but it's more apt to be a pop kind of beat instead of a jazz beat. I will tell you about Figure Eight. It was a beautiful little melody. Sounds like a sonata almost. And I used to play it around my house, and my late wife said, "What is that melody?" And I said, "Oh, I was thinking maybe it'd be an eight. Song about eight," and she said, "Oh no, it's too good for Schoolhouse Rock." And I said, "Yeah, you're right." And I wrote a different one, and they didn't like it. So, in a bit of desperation, I decided to finish it, and I wrote Figure Eight. And it starts out with this very placid melody. In the middle, it goes into a rock beat where they multiply by eight. but the outside was very dreamy. In fact, we recorded it with a cellist.
Would you sing a few lines of Figure Eight for us?
Figure Eight, that's double four. Figure Four, that's half of eight. If you skate, you will be great when you can make a figure eight. That's a circle that turns round upon itself.
When you were first getting started musically, you were one of the people who was chasing the bird, so to speak. I mean, you were really deep into Charlie Parker and wanted to emulate him. And you didn't sing very much because you were afraid that singing would seem corny or too commercial, too showbiz. And so it wasn't until I think you got to Paris in the 50s for a little bit that you actually started singing a lot.
Deep down in my heart, I did want to sing, and I didn't do it as much because I also wanted to be a bebop piano player, and you know, I would never say to one of my colleagues, "Let me sing one." On the other hand, there were occasions where the band got a job, and the boss would say, "Does anybody in the band sing?" And you know, they say, "Yeah, the piano players." And you know, I would do Route 66 or some rhythm tune, just to show them that somebody in the band could sing. It was on the Paris job at the Mars Club in Paris that I had full sway and was able to call my own shots. I was the boss. I was working alone mostly, but I would call up the songs I wanted to sing, and I developed my style or my act sort of there.
What did you, what inspired your approach to singing? Is there a singer who you were emulating, or...?
There were several of them that, not that I emulated them, but I got inspired by them. By and large, they're the horn players who sing, like Louis Armstrong and Dizzy Gillespie and Trummy Young. And then, of course, Nat King Cole, a piano player who sang. Musicians who sing inspired me more than... Not that I didn't admire Sinatra or Tony Bennett or any of those guys, but when a jazz man would sing, that would be my thing, you know. I'd say, hey, I can do that.
Bob Doro recorded last year. His new CD is called Right on My Way Home. Let's go back to a record he made with Miles Davis in 1962, Blue Christmas.
Merry Christmas. I hope you have a white one, but for me, it's blue. Blue Christmas. That's the way you see it when you're feeling blue. Blue Xmas. When you're blue at Christmas time, you see right through all the waste, all the sham, all the haste, and plain old bad taste. Sidewalk Santa Clauses are much, much, much too thin. They're wearing fancy rented costumes, false beards, and big fat phony grins. And nearly everybody's standing around holding out their empty hand or tin cup. Gimme, 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 fill my stocking up, all the way up. It's a time when the greedy give a dime to the needy. Blue Christmas. All the paper tinsel and the fal-de-ral. Blue Xmas. People trading gifts that matter not at all. What I call fal-de-ral, bitter gall. Fal-de-ral.
Coming up, Christmas Rhythm and Blues from Charles Brown. This is Fresh Air. Mm-hmm. Two classic R&B Christmas records were made by Charles Brown, Merry Christmas Baby and Please Come Home for Christmas. This year, Charles Brown turned 75 and he went to the White House to receive a Heritage Fellowship Award from the National Endowment for the Arts. He'll perform some of his songs and talk about his career February 25th at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Brown had 9 top 10 R&B singles between 1946 and 52, including Driftin' Blues. He started making a comeback in the 80s. We're going to present an excerpt of our 1989 live concert with Charles Brown. I asked him to play Merry Christmas, Baby.
They know me for that. No care where I go, whatever time of year. Christmas, baby, you sure did treat me nice. Merry Christmas, baby, sure did treat me nice. Gave me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise. Well, I'm feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my stereo. Feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my radio. Well, I wanna kiss you, baby. While you're standing beneath the mistletoe. Satan ain't coming down the chimney yet, too.
Well, you've influenced a lot of singers, and one of the many people you've influenced was Mose Allison, who recorded one of the songs that you did,
Fool's Paradise.
Yeah.
Sam Cooke did, too, and a lot of the other people. I don't know, John A. Fuller wrote this number. He was imitating me in San Francisco, and Leo Mester and Eddie Mester would go out as talent scouts and to find tunes that would fit me. And they heard this number being number one in San Francisco because this company that had it wasn't able to send it across the country and distribution. So he said, Charles, since they're trying to imitate you doing Fool's Paradise, why don't you do it? Then I did Fool's Paradise, and it was a great hit for me.
Would you play it for us?
Yes, I will. I often think of the life I live. It's a wonder Charles Brown ain't dead. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise. My mother told me, father told me too. Someday my child, fate's gonna catch up with you. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise. Though I've learned my lesson, like all fools I've met, I've learned things are in this world. I remember to my dying day, my my mother told me. Father said it right. Said Charles Brown, you're running your life. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night. Living in a fool's paradise. Living in a fool's paradise. That's it.
That's great. Charles Brown, recorded in 1989. Coming up, a review of the new movie Titanic. This is Fresh Air. After months of production delays, dissension on the set, and budget trouble, James Cameron's Titanic arrived at movie theaters today. It's the most expensive film ever, costing $200 million. Titanic stars Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. John Powers has a review.
Everybody knows the story of the Titanic, the famously opulent ocean liner that sank on its maiden voyage, killing 1,500 of the 2,200 people on board. This glamorous disaster is the backdrop of James Cameron's much-publicized romantic epic named after the ill-starred ship. The year is 1912, and Rose DeWitt Bucater, played by Kate Winslet, is an upper-crust teenager traveling on the Titanic along with her mother and Cal Hockley, the rich, thuggish Philistine she's being forced to marry. On the verge of suicide, Rose encounters Jack Dawson, who's played by Leonardo DiCaprio. Jack's a penniless young passenger in steerage who has all the love of freedom that's missing from her snooty, money-mad social circle. The two are just beginning their love affair when, bam, the Titanic hits that iceberg. The movie was both scripted and directed by Cameron, who's best known for the Terminator movies and True Lies. His ambition has always reached beyond gargantuan explosions, and here he risks a full-fledged love story. It is a risk, because to put it bluntly, Cameron's far better at blowing things up than he is at writing good dialogue. His screenplay is filled with howlers, kitsch, and silent movie broadness. Rose's villainous fiancé, who's stridently played by Billy Zane, would twirl his mustache if he had one. Despite all this, the movie pulls us in. As Rose, Kate Winslet starts out rather stiff and unalluring, but she gets more spirited and radiant as the story progresses. For Titanic is about Rose's transformation from a passive girl to a daring, taboo-busting woman. She's forever changed by the free-spirited Jack, who's imbued with Leonardo DiCaprio's peculiar charisma. Although he's got a manly man's ability to protect a woman, he has the face of a beautiful, sensitive boy. You can just imagine the high school girls in the audience swooning when Jack gets invited to dinner with the first-class passengers and explains how he lives his life.
And where exactly do you live, Mr. Dawson?
Well, right now my address is the RMS Titanic. After that, I'm on God's good humor.
And how is it you have means to travel?
I work my way from place to place, you know, tramp steamers and such. But I won my ticket on Titanic here at a lucky hand at poker. A very lucky hand.
All life is a game of luck.
A real man makes his own luck, Archie. Right, Dawson?
And you find that sort of rootless existence appealing, do you?
Well, yes, ma'am, I do. I mean, got everything I need right here with me. Got air in my lungs and a few blank sheets of paper. I mean, I love waking up in the morning not knowing what's going to happen or who I'm going to meet, where I'm going to wind up. Just the other night, I was sleeping under a bridge, and now here I am on the grandest ship in the world having champagne with you fine people.
Cameron has never been an ideas man, and the movie gives only cursory glances at some of Titanic's potentially rich themes, such as the modern worship of technology. But Cameron does make a big point about social class, using the ship as a metaphor for a whole society. Up in first class, it's all champagne and evening dress. On the lower decks, it's beer, bunks, and rowdiness. Meanwhile, in the boiler rooms, sweating men are slaves to enormous Dante-esque furnaces. These class distinctions hold fast, even in the face of death. As waters flood the ship, most passengers are kept caged on the lower decks, while the rich saunter around an elegant ballroom. There aren't enough lifeboats for everyone, so first-class women and children are boarded first. The others are left to die in the freezing Atlantic. The systematic cruelty of this is so blatant that Titanic often seems like the first Hollywood blockbuster to have been scripted by Karl Marx. Still, nobody's going to see this movie for a social history lesson. Titanic rises and falls on one thing: whether audiences feel what it was like to be on that fateful voyage. And it's here that Cameron succeeds triumphantly. We feel the ocean liner's legendary size and grandeur, its sumptuous staterooms, its string quintets, and labyrinthine lower decks teeming with immigrants of all nations and hues. And once it hits the iceberg, amazing digital effects capture the overwhelming scale of this disaster: the onrushing water, the bodies sliding down decks and being thrown overboard, the ship plunging into the sea like a drowning skyscraper, the corpses bobbing in icy waters. The movie lasts a bit over 3 hours, 20 minutes longer than it took the actual ship to sink, and most viewers will spend the last hour rapt at the sheer spectacle. This is the most expensive film ever made, and it's one measure of Cameron's success that you won't waste your time asking how he spent the $200 million. Big, corny, and exhaustingly spectacular, Titanic is the kind of grand entertainment that only Hollywood can make, but all too often does not.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Tell old Santa what's on my mind. Lord, I got to tell old Santa what is on my mind. Well, I know I've been a good boy. Now it's getting Christmas time.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMI. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mama, he treats your daughter me.
On the next Fresh Air, rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown, one of Atlantic Records' first hit makers. She has a new CD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.